From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, journalism and the bottom line. We talk with Dom Kunkel and Gene Roberts, authors of Leaving Readers Behind, The Age of Corporate Newspapering. Kunkel and Roberts say the pressure to increase profits at newspapers is affecting what stories are covered and how they're covered. Roberts is the former executive editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Kunkel is the dean of the University of Maryland's School of Journalism. Then I'll look at the history of one newspaper, the Los Angeles Times, with Dennis McDougall, a former Times reporter, who has written a new book about the family that owned the paper for most of the 20th century. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. President Bush and European leaders clashed over climate change policies as they met in Sweden today. The Swedish Prime Minister said Mr. Bush, who has scrapped the Kyoto Global Warming Accords in favor of more study and creation of new strategies, is pushing policies that endanger the environment. The president remained unwavering in opposing a global warming treaty. Outside the meeting in the coastal town of Gothenburg, hundreds of demonstrators threw bottles and cobblestones. They were protesting globalization, the European Union, and President Bush's policies on the environment and defense. The Senate passed a major education reform bill today. It would require reading and math testing of all students and hold schools responsible for the results. But the bill did not pass before partisan debate and approval of an amendment from Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. The amendment would withhold federal funds from school districts that bar the Boy Scouts of America from using school facilities. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Although the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the Boy Scouts can prohibit gays from being members, Senator Jesse Helms, Republican of North Carolina, the sponsor of the amendment, argued that public school officials have routinely prevented the Boy Scouts from recruiting or conducting meetings on their campuses.
If a public elementary school or a public secondary school discriminates against the Boy Scouts of America or any other youth group, then that school will be in jeopardy of losing its federal funds.
Opponents of Helms' amendment argued in vain that school districts could be sued for sponsoring an organization that discriminates against homosexuals. Robert Byrd of West Virginia was among a handful of Democrats, though, who voted for the amendment on the condition that it include safeguards to keep groups like the Ku Klux Klan from demanding access to school facilities. I'm Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Airline pilots and Delta subsidiary Comair have reached a tentative agreement. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
The deal came at the end of 3 days of talks between Comair management and the Airline Pilots Association, facilitated by federal mediators. Details are not yet clear, but the pilots' negotiating team is recommending a yes vote. That vote will take place as quickly as possible, probably over the next 10 days or so. Comair pilots walked off the job March 26th after more than 2 years of negotiations. They rejected an offer made last month because it didn't meet their requirements on rest between shifts and pay for non-flying time. Regional airline pilots also have traditionally earned less money than those who work for major airlines. Since the strike began, Comair has canceled flights, laid off workers, and sold planes. The company has lost more than $200 million. Comair hopes to reschedule flights soon. Emily Harris, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow Industrials lost 181 points to 10,690 today. The Nasdaq fell 77 to 2044. This is NPR News. Navy bombing exercises will stop on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. President Bush today ordered the Navy to look for another site for the practice sessions. Activist Minister Al Sharpton, who's in jail for his protests of the Vieques bombing runs, said today the president's announcement is a step in the right direction. But Sharpton said the bombing should stop immediately rather than be continued until another site is found. Drought conditions in northern Wyoming and southern Montana have eased in part thanks to an unusually large June snowstorm. Aaron Alpern of Wyoming Public Radio has details.
Snowfall is not uncommon in the mountains this time of year, but it is rare to see storms producing this much precipitation. Snowfall averaged between 6 and 12 inches in the region, with some areas receiving over 20 inches. The moisture couldn't come at a better time for this drought-stricken area, Alan Ross with the National Weather Service says this will alleviate some of those dry conditions.
This event will do a good deal of help in the short term, say the 30-day drought situation. But when you look at a period of 3 months or 6 months, this would be a small event, especially if we do not get subsequent precipitation events over the next 3 to 6 months.
Ross says the storm will also reduce the short-term risk of wildfires in the region, but the risk could go back up if dry conditions return. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Alpern in Laramie, Wyoming.
An FBI sniper who shot and killed the wife of white separatist Randy Weaver at Ruby Ridge, Idaho in 1992 will not be prosecuted. An Idaho County prosecutor issued his decision today. The decision follows last week's sharply divided U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that FBI agent Lou Horiuchi could face trial for involuntary manslaughter. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, offering customized wealth management services for qualified investors. 1-800-MERRILL or www.askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests, Gene Roberts and Tom Kunkel, say that the American newspaper industry is in the middle of the most momentous change in its 300-year history, a change that is diminishing the amount of real news available to the consumer. This is the result of the corporatization of the industry, which is culminating in a blitz of buying, selling, and consolidating of newspapers from the mightiest dailies to the humblest weeklies. The pressure to increase profits is affecting what stories get covered and how they get covered. Roberts and Kunkel are the editors of the new book Leaving Readers Behind, The Age of Corporate Newspapering. Roberts is the former executive editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, former managing editor of the New York Times, and is now a professor at the University of Maryland College of Journalism. Tom Kunkel is the dean of the College of Journalism, the publisher of the American Journalism Review, and former deputy managing editor of the San Jose Mercury News. One of the current newspaper trends is clustering, where one company buys several papers in one region. This can cut down on publishing costs, allow the consolidation of management, and cut down on staff through pool reporting. For example, one reporter might cover state politics for several different papers. I asked Kunkel if this type of pool coverage is becoming typical.
It is typical, and it may mean in some cases that a company might actually bring more resources to, say, state government coverage. But more typically what happens is that it has the effect of reducing the number of reporters, say, at a state house. If you look at a state like New Jersey, for instance, two companies, the Newhouse Company and the Gannett Company, now own between them 14 of the 19 or so newspapers in the state. They have between them 75% of the daily circulation in the state. Now, you know, whatever you think about those two companies, you know, when you have this situation where fewer companies operate more newspapers, they consider that they don't need as many people to cover the state house or to cover a sports franchise or whatever. And so you end up with fewer people on the ground typically, and therefore the reader suffers because he doesn't have as much coverage at his or her disposal.
Well, but maybe it's not necessarily a bad thing. Maybe, like, the best of the reporters are the ones covering sports and state politics now, so even the readers in the more mediocre papers will have the advantage of, you know, the best reporter on the beat. What would be wrong with that?
Well, in that event, I mean, that's fine to have better people doing it. But in general, you know, without talking about the specific qualities of an individual involved, in general, we're talking about situations where competition gets reduced and there are fewer people on the ground. And so the odds are that what happens is that certain stories don't get covered. It may be that one or two people are doing a very good job covering certain stories, but maybe 10 years ago there were six or eight people trying to cover the same story. So more stories got written, there was more competition, there was more of an effort to develop sources there.
And better localization of the news.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Typically, in, say, a state legislature, a bill will have widespread effect. And if you're localizing the coverage of it, the writer will explain exactly how this proposed legislation would affect the writer's hometown newspaper, and thus the readers, and the news is thereby closer to the readers. makes more sense to them, has more application to their lives. And if when newspapers start setting up their own mini wire services, they essentially end up duplicating the Associated Press and other wire services, as opposed to writing specifically for their readers in their area of circulation.
Are there new types of corporations that are getting into the newspaper business, that are buying up newspapers without any experience running newspapers?
Yes, in fact, that's one of the things that we document in our series that I think a lot of people, even in the business, didn't realize. Two of the biggest newspaper chains that today exist 5 years ago did not exist. These were sort of instant chains, as you will, business interests that decided they wanted to go into newspapers and started buying up properties around the country. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but these are interests that really have no experience or expertise in newspapers, and so it sort of makes you wonder what their motivations are. Well, in fact, we know that their motivations are financial. And again, there's nothing wrong with that, except that they don't have any real experience in terms of what quality newspaper content means, why it's important.
Are there more bottom-line pressures now than in the past? Gene Roberts, I'd be interested in your opinion of that. You know, as former executive editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, former managing editor of the New York Times, you've been in the newspaper business a long time. What are the bottom-line pressures now compared to, say, the 80s?
More and more newspaper corporations are now publicly held. That is, they're stock corporations, and many are traded on Wall Street. And this brings pressure from analysts if they want to keep their stock price up. And now newspaper chains own more than 75% of all the 1,500 daily newspapers in America. And most of those corporations are public.
Do you think editors are being asked to do things that they weren't asked to do in the past because of financial pressures to cut costs and increase circulation?
Oh, they definitely are. And in fact, a lot of them have left because they reached the point where they realize that they're no longer doing the things that they loved, why they got in the business, which is to say journalism. And they spend virtually all their time, you know, over spreadsheets trying to make decisions about how many pages to cut out of the news hole because they're over budget, or how many positions they have to leave open in their newsroom or lose because they're being pressed to, you know, bring their expenses down. And increasingly they're frustrated because it doesn't take that much of a spur in the economy to trigger those sorts of reactions from their corporate bosses. So it's a very frustrating situation for editors. They're in a very difficult place today.
I know that there's a lot of pressure on editors now to make budget cuts and even to cut certain coverage in the newspaper in an attempt to save money. Is there also pressure to boost certain aspects of the coverage in the belief that boosting that coverage would help increase circulation?
In general, there's a belief that sports coverage helps and business coverage helps. And I don't question that. And I think the one upside of the trends we're talking about today is that sports and business sections in most American newspapers have gotten better. But in many cases, rather than put fresh money into this, they simply cut it out of other areas of news coverage, so you have a general diminishment of coverage. In some towns, there's one Maryland town in particular I'm thinking of, news cutbacks have been so serious that in this town, the police reporter can no longer find the time to go to the police station to get the news. So the newspaper put a fax machine in the police station, and the police now decide what news coverage you're going to get out of the police department, and they select the stories and put them on the fax machine. And if there's one that they find embarrassing or so forth, then this is the price you have to pay for those kind of budget cut.
Why was the police reporter too busy to actually go to police headquarters and report on the police?
Because he was covering all the surrounding counties. They had gotten rid of other newspaper reporters and put all the burden on this one reporter. And he literally was so busy making phone calls to so many coverage areas he had responsibility for that he just didn't have time to get in his car and go to the police station.
Gene Roberts, is the profit margin at newspapers expected to be higher now than it was in the past? Does that have to do with the pressure to make more money now, or is it just that circulation's down, so it's harder to make
no,
money?
No, it's distinct pressure for higher profits, and they're already among the highest of any American industry. Last year, for example, the typical public newspaper company made almost 22% operating profit. That is, of every dollar that goes on into the cash register, the company hangs on to 22 cents. The auto companies in America don't make even a fifth as much in terms of operating profits as newspapers do.
So in your estimation, some of the owners of newspapers have unreasonable profit expectations?
Yes, and especially in economic downturns. Newspapers are extremely sensitive to the economy because if people aren't buying, then merchants aren't advertising, and because advertising makes up a big percentage of the revenue, this creates a problem for newspapers. And increasingly, rather than just settle for, say, 19% operating profit as opposed to 22%, what they do is cut back space and cut back manpower in newsrooms, and suddenly the reader is getting a diminished newspaper.
You know, many newspapers have used this current bit of trouble to, for instance, kill their local Sunday news, their local Sunday magazine. There now are fewer than 20, maybe only a dozen or so newspapers in the country that have their own Sunday supplement. I mean, that's terrible. I mean, survey after survey, you know, readers say they really like their Sunday magazines. But because the companies look at them as cost centers unto themselves, you know, they make very inviting targets when times get a little tough, and so they knife them. But that's another piece of the paper that the consumers like that they don't have anymore. And, you know, it's just incredibly short-sighted.
If newspapers run at such a high profit margin, Gene Roberts, you were saying 22%, why would a newspaper want to sell?
Because they make those kind of profit margins, they have been getting record offers for the papers from people who want to buy them. And in many cases, especially cases where the papers are locally owned, this may be the fourth generation or the fifth generation of that family that owns the paper. So you have a lot of cousins, a lot of ownership interests that have been, frankly, they may not be quite so interested in the operation of the paper anymore, and they're interested in cashing out. And there's never been a better time to cash out because the papers are going for such tremendously high multiples right now. And so there's just too much money at stake.
My guests are Tom Kunkel and Gene Roberts, editors of the new book Leaving Readers Behind, The Age of Corporate Newspapering. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Tom Kunkel and Gene Roberts, editors of the new book Leaving Readers Behind, The Age of Corporate Newspapering. And this book is a result of their project, The Project on the State of the American Newspaper. Let's look at the newspapers that you used to work at and see how they're doing now. Gene Roberts, you were the executive editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. You left there in 1990. How many years had you been in that position?
I had been in it 18 years.
And you left because of budget cuts?
That, I would say, was the principal reason, not just budget cuts, but the general climate. In general, every year for about 5 years in succession, it had gotten tougher and tougher to negotiate a reasonable budget for the newsroom. And it finally reached the point that they didn't want to discuss what the budget of a newsroom would be. They simply wanted to figure out how much profit they wanted to make and give you a certain percentage of that profit. And it was almost totally by the numbers and was not a result of a meaningful discussion about what the paper ought to be doing.
One of the things you were known for when you were the editor at the Inquirer was the investigative pieces and the number of Pulitzer Prizes that those pieces won. I think there were, 17 Pulitzer Prizes during your years as executive editor?
Yes, that's
right. And this is for a paper that had never won a Pulitzer before you got there. Correct me if I'm wrong. So investigative pieces tend to cost a lot of money because you have one or more reporters, usually more than one, working on a story for a long period of time without being able to publish until the investigation is through. Were you kind of forced to cut down on investigative work because of bottom line concerns?
I had not at the time I left, but if the trend had continued, I would have been forced to do that. And I think a good newspaper just simply has to have complicated news stories in it at times, like investigative stories. If not, what you're telling the reader is we cover the easy news. If it's expensive or hard to get, then we don't cover that. And that is no way to run a newspaper.
Tom Kunkel, you were deputy managing editor at the San Jose Mercury News. Were there bottom line pressures on you in that position?
Yeah, it's a wonderful paper, and it was a wonderful paper when I was there, and I enjoyed working there. But one of the reasons I left was exactly the sorts of things that Gene is talking about, and in fact, it was about the same time. This was the first time after a record run-up out in San Jose that in the early 90s where the paper was really forced to have to look at its spending, to cut back on staff, on space, on travel, and things like that. It was not something they were accustomed to doing. I had to do it at other places, so unfortunately I was pretty good at it. But it's sort of a soul-draining, dispiriting exercise because you have so much pride and talent in a place like that that nobody wants to do a worse job. I mean, You want to do these things, but still keep the paper as good as it is. And so, you know, you end up putting these enormous demands on yourself and your reporters and your editors, trying to do just as good a job with less space, less time, and fewer people. And it's exhausting.
One of the things that has changed for newspaper readers is that they don't rely on newspapers for breaking news in the way that they once did. You get the breaking news a lot quicker on radio and TV, particularly now with the proliferation of all news TV stations as well as radio stations. How do you think that needs to be addressed by newspapers? Do you think that newspapers have to redefine their mission and focus on maybe a deeper version of the news instead of covering just the breaking aspect of the news?
Yeah, I think detail is very important because on television you just get the surface, the quick in and out. And people will go to newspapers for more detail, more nuance. And unfortunately, given the current attitudes on newspapers, detail takes space and takes manpower to supply. And the very things that make a newspaper special are among the first things to go in a budget crunch. And it's quite disturbing, I think, for the future of newspapers and for society as well.
Something else that has changed recently for newspapers is websites. A lot of newspapers have invested a lot of money in having good websites, both for the daily paper, for the archives of the paper, and for supplements to the daily paper, additional breaking news stories as they happen. But a lot of things on the Internet aren't panning out the way people expected. At this point, are most newspapers losing money or making money or gaining readers through the websites? How are newspapers thinking about their investments in their websites now?
Well, they're still trying to sort out whether they think the online is their enemy or their friend, their future or their demise. But I think for the most part, they realize that it's a wonderful opportunity. And in fact, the current shakeout of the dot-com industry at large has been a boon to newspapers because newspapers have the local franchise and they have the financial backing to hang in there and to get people who do get their news online accustomed to going to their site to find out what's going on. So it can be, we think it can be a very good thing for newspapers if they recognize it as a tool. But it is just that it's a tool. It's almost less important whether, what the delivery method of a story is. What's more important is what's in the story itself. So, tomorrow you're going to be able to get a story online or in your paper or whatever, and some people, are going to prefer one method over the other. But what's important is that the story be there.
I think there's been a lot of kind of fear about the new media. Will they hurt or will they harm the existing media? Do you think that the new media is adding a lot of pressure to reporters? Are reporters having to take on putting material on the Internet in addition to their responsibilities reporting for the newspaper? Are reporters... Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, it does put a lot of pressure on them, and a lot of them are worried about it. I mean, many reporters appreciate that that online is a wonderful opportunity in a sense. But on the other hand, what you're asking them to do, for instance, whoever was covering the execution of Timothy McVeigh, which was 8 o'clock on the East Coast, I mean, they had to file instantly for their online operations, and that's fine. But this is and then they would have to file updates, and these are the kinds of things that they didn't used to have to do. And I think a lot of reporters are feeling rather pressed that they have to meet the demands of online. They don't have the time to really dig into the story the way they might like.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Our pleasure.
Well, thank you.
Tom Kunkel and Gene Roberts are the editors of Leaving Readers Behind. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at SaabUSA.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the history of the Los Angeles Times and the family that owned it through most of the 20th century. We talk with former Times reporter Dennis McDougall, author of a new book about the paper. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Los Angeles Times is one of the best newspapers in America, but it used to be widely acknowledged as one of the worst. News anchor Chet Huntley once joked that he always read the Los Angeles Times and knew he could be reasonably accurate by going 180 degrees in the other direction. My guest Dennis McDougall is the author of a new book about the history of the Times and the Chandler family that owned it for over 100 years. The book focuses on the paper's fourth publisher, Otis Chandler, who turned the paper around. The book is called Privileged Son, Otis Chandler and the Rise and Fall of the L.A. Times Dynasty. McDougall was a reporter at the Times from 1981 to 92, a period at the paper he describes as nirvana for journalists. I asked McDougall to describe the Los Angeles Times politics in its early years.
The Los Angeles Times was a right-wing, right of Attila the Hun, Republican rag throughout most of its history. It was founded back in the 1880s and quickly fell into the hands of Otis Chandler's great-grandfather, General Harrison Otis, who started out, interestingly enough, as sort of a Union firebrand when he was a typesetter back in Ohio prior to the Civil War. But by the time he got to California in the 1880s, he became this virulent anti-Union firebrand. And his newspaper reflected that voice. He turned the Los Angeles Times in the space of a few years into the preeminent newspaper in the United States for management in what turned out to be basically a national civil war between labor and management throughout the first couple of decades of the 20th century.
What were some of the other issues that the LA Times supported?
Well, it became a rah-rah sheet for Southern California. It was for many years, for better than half a century, the Los Angeles Times published what it called its midwinter edition, which came out every January and was put on the trains and sent back to the East Coast and the Midwest for the express purpose of hyping the climate and the agriculture and the palm trees and the blue skies, the wonderful, wonderful Eden on Earth that Los Angeles was believed to have been in the first half of the 20th century. And that was expressly to bring people to the West Coast so that they would buy real estate, much of which was owned by Otis Chandler's grandfather, Harry Chandler.
What were some of the holdings that the family had?
I guess at one time it was well in excess of 1.5 million acres. This would have been probably in the teens and the early 20s. But Harry Chandler was this fabulous character who out-hearsted William Randolph Hearst, began building real estate syndicates to buy up large swaths of land in Southern California in the early part of the 20th century, the best known of which, of course, was the San Fernando Valley, the basis of the motion picture Chinatown rests on the legacy of Harry Chandler. And in fact, the John Huston character in Chinatown is patterned after Harry Chandler. The Chandlers owned a huge ranch that straddled the Mexican border between Baja California and California, some 860,000 acres. It was so large and so productive from an agricultural standpoint that in the late teens and early 20s of the 20th century, it was the largest producer of cotton in the world. And his biggest holding that up until just a few years ago remained in the hands of the Chandler family is still the largest undeveloped piece of privately held property in Southern California. It's called the Tejon Ranch, and it's between Los Angeles and a Bakersfield. It's a huge property that is that also just happens to be the place where the California Aqueduct pumps its water into Los Angeles.
You write that for most of the 20th century, the L.A. Times and its publishers dictated Southern California politics. How did the paper use its political muscle?
Well, all the way back to General Harrison Otis's time, which was roughly 1880 until his death in 1917, the Times was adjudged to be the house organ of the California Republican Party. It came down to what's good for business in Southern California, not necessarily what's good for the people, but how do we make the booming economy boom even more? How do we make the growing population burgeon beyond its limits? So, any kind of political policy that favored the development of real estate, the increase of water resources or any other kind of resources, transportation, anything that would make Southern California an attractive place for an Easterner to finally set down roots and become part of the economy, that became the policy promulgated by the Los Angeles Times.
My guest is Dennis McDougall, author of Privileged Son, It's a History of the Los Angeles Times, and the Chandler family, which owned it for over 100 years. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dennis McDougall, author of Privileged Son, Otis Chandler, and the Rise and Fall of the Los Angeles Times Dynasty. Let's use Richard Nixon as an example of a candidate who the LA Times backed when he started his political career. He first ran as a Republican candidate in a Democratic congressional district in 1946. Why did the Times support Nixon then?
Well, Richard Nixon had a well-known godfather named Murray Chotiner, and it was Chotiner who advised Nixon to get the support of all of the newspapers that published in the targeted Democratic congressional seat that he was seeking. And the Los Angeles Times, of course, had the largest circulation. He went to the Times and met with Norman Chandler and his chief political correspondent, a fellow named Kyle Palmer, who was regarded as being the kingmaker in California at the time. And they liked what they saw, an ambitious young man, a World War II veteran, who was virulently anti-labor and pro-business, and they backed him 110%.
Yeah, you say that the paper wrote fawning headlines in spite of Nixon's smear tactics in his campaign. Do you remember any of the headlines?
Oh, gosh, not off the top of my head. I mean, it was supposedly Kyle Palmer who came up with the idea of labeling Helen Gehagen Douglas the Pink Lady. She was the Democratic state senator who ran against Nixon for California's Senate seat in 1950, and he soundly trounced her, again with the help of the Los Angeles Times. If you were a Democrat, you simply did not exist. It was almost a Stalinist approach to partisan politics. If you were anything other than a Republican, you deserved no ink whatsoever in the Los Angeles Times.
What role did the Los Angeles Times play, if any, in Nixon's nomination to the vice presidency in 1952?
By that time, Norman Chandler, the third in the line of Chandlers, or Otis's and Chandlers, was publisher of the Los Angeles Times, and he had married a young department store heiress from Long Beach. Dorothy Buffum was her maiden name, and she became Dorothy Buffum Chandler. And it was Dorothy in 1952 who, probably more so than either Norman Chandler, her husband, or Kyle Palmer, the political editor of the Los Angeles Times, who championed for Richard Nixon as the vice presidential candidate at the convention in Chicago. She actually went to a publisher of a Chicago newspaper and asked him to plant stories, speculative stories, on the front page about this young senator from California as being a dark horse candidate for the vice presidency, so that she could increase his chances of becoming Eisenhower's running mate.
Yeah, the year that Richard Nixon ran for the presidency is the same year that Otis Chandler took over the Los Angeles Times, and it was Chandler who basically ended the Times' reputation for being a right-wing paper. Chandler was the fourth publisher of the Times. He was 32 when he took it over in 1960. What were the first steps that he made in the direction of having a paper that wasn't a political mouthpiece?
Otis was a cipher. He came out of nowhere, and everyone automatically assumed, because he looked like the Southern California golden boy, his appearance was that of a know-nothing surfer dude, that that he was just going to be a reflection, probably a poor reflection, of his lackluster father, Norman, and that it was just going to be business as usual at the Los Angeles Times. And they were in for a big surprise, because the very first thing that Otis Chandler and his very talented editor, Nick Williams, did was commission a five-part series on the John Birch Society, which unmasked the... I mean, we forget about it now, but back in the late 50s, the John Birch Society was a power to be reckoned with. It was a right-wing group that believed that, you know, there was a communist under every rock. And Otis very courageously commissioned this five-part series and then wrote a front-page editorial, signed editorial, saying that the John Birch Society should be uprooted and run out of the country. Now, what makes that particularly courageous is the fact that Otis Chandler's aunt and uncle, Norman Chandler's brother and sister-in-law, were leaders of the John Birch Society in Southern California. So he was actually, at that point, going against the family. A short time after that, Philip Chandler, who was a ranking member of the board of trustees of the company that owned the Times, resigned in disgrace and died a few years after that. But he also, that is, Otis, also planted the seeds for rancor that would eventually lead to his own demise as publisher of the Times.
Well, when Otis Chandler took over the paper, how did the coverage of Richard Nixon change in the LA Times?
Well, it's kind of funny because, you know, Otis took over as publisher, and basically what he did was instruct Nick Williams, his editor, and all of Nick's subordinates to begin covering both sides of the news. That meant covering both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. That meant covering the negative side of a candidate as well as the positive side of a candidate. And Richard Nixon, who had been born and bred throughout his political life on the notion of always getting positive press in the Los Angeles Times, was in for a rude awakening. Because what happened then from his loss to John Kennedy until his loss of the California gubernatorial election to Pat Brown 2 years later was that the Los Angeles Times began reporting his gaffes when he made some sweeping statistical statement about California and some negative statement about his opponent. The reporter would actually go to the opponent and say, "Is that true?" This was astonishing. Nixon had never run into this before, and he felt betrayed. So in 1962, when he ran for the California governorship against Pat Brown and he lost, he staged his famous press conference in which he told the gathered members of the Fourth Estate that they wouldn't have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore. And he specifically, Dorothy Chandler pointed this out years later, he specifically was aiming his comments towards the Los Angeles Times.
Did he ever try to do anything to retaliate against the Times?
I mean, for the next several years, of course, he went into semi-seclusion and began planning for his resurrection, which, of course, happened in 1968. But Nixon, of course, never forgot, and when an opportunity presented itself, he did what he could to get back at the Chandlers, and Otis in particular. On a recently released tape from the Nixon tape archives, there is a conversation between Nixon and H.R. Haldeman about Otis Chandler, who at the time lived in the very upscale suburb of San Marino, and how all of Otis Chandler's servants were Mexican, and that, as Nixon unceremoniously put it in his unguarded speech in the Oval Office, they were wetbacks, and he said that these people could be shipped back to Mexico with ease if he could turn the INS loose on him. And he just reveled in the idea of doing that and embarrassing Otis Chandler as much as possible.
My guest is Dennis McDougall, author of Privileged Son, A History of the Los Angeles Times and the Chandler Family, which owned it for over 100 years. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Dennis McDougall. His new book is called Privileged Son, Otis Chandler and the Rise and Fall of the L.A. Times Dynasty. But when Otis Chandler took over the Times, what are some of the changes that he made in addition to insisting on more politically fair coverage?
Well, again, you have to remember that the Los Angeles Times, even though it was a Republican rag, was easily, at the time that Otis took over, the richest newspaper in the United States, or fast approaching it. It had more advertising lineage than any other newspaper. There was money galore, but it was not being put back into the newspaper. And that was what Otis began to initiate the second that he took over. He opened foreign bureaus all over the world. I mean, he patterned the Los Angeles Times in many respects after the New York Times, which he greatly respected and which he regarded as his chief competition. He also opened national bureaus in every major city in the United States. He beefed up the Washington Bureau such that it was at least as competitive and had as many bodies typing away in it as the New York Times. And his whole attitude was, we have this revenue-producing sheet that goes out to people, and apparently they like it enough to subscribe to it in droves. Now we're going to turn this into a top-notch newspaper. It's going to be literary. It's going to have the best journalists that money can buy. And that's exactly what he did. He went out and hired away the best people that he could from the East Coast journalism establishment.
When and why did Otis Chandler step down from his position as publisher of the Times?
Well, Otis stepped down in 1986 officially. This is something that's still difficult for him to talk about. I spent a wrenching afternoon with him near the end of our interviews when I was trying to pull the information out of him. You know, it had been reported elsewhere that something had gone on, that he did not leave of his own volition. And he's always maintained all these years that that's exactly what he did, that he'd put in 25 good years at the Los Angeles Times and that it was time for him to move on. But he did this when he was still in his 50s and still had many good years ahead of him.
Why was Otis Chandler pushed out of the LA Times?
Otis planted the seeds of his demise in 1960 when he published the five-part series on the John Birch Society. It alienated not only his aunt and uncle, but several other members of his family. In fact, the majority of his cousins thought that he had begun turning the Los Angeles Times to the left. His hiring of liberal icons like cartoonist Paul Conrad and the editorial page editor Anthony Day really turned off the members of the Chandler family, who silently sat in the background but collected their corporate dividends on a regular basis, and sat on the board of directors of the Times Mirror Company. And by the early 1980s, when he began to recede from the paper, his marriage had broken up in 1980, and he remarried and began to go on more and more vacations. It was the right time for the other side of the Chandler family to strike and take back the newspaper. That's basically what happened. There was a somewhat convoluted, for want of a better term, palace coup in 1985 when the chief executive officer of Times Mirror, Robert Oberu, sent a group of trustees from the Times Mirror board to Otis's office and told him that his time was up. Otis went out to dinner that night and wept over a bottle of wine about what had happened to him, but basically he understood or believed that he was powerless to do anything about it. So with good grace, he went ahead and accepted it, the decision of the board, and stepped down as chairman of the Times Mirror Company and pretty much walked away from the newspaper. I mean, he was still on the board of directors, but his voice became more and more that of a dissident as the years passed and the paper moved in a different direction.
Well, Dennis McDougall, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Terry.
Dennis McDougall is the author of the new book, Privileged Son, Otis Chandler, and the Rise and Fall of the L.A. Times Dynasty. Last year, the L.A. Times was sold to the Chicago Tribune Company. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shirok. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll hear from Lori Pepper, who's produced a new box set by her late husband, the saxophonist Art Pepper. It's called Art Pepper, The Hollywood All-Star Sessions. We'll close with a track from it. Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Dell Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of The Greatest Generation by Tom Brokaw, available in paperback. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Lori Pepper talks about her marriage to a gifted but troubled and addicted jazz musician, the late Art Pepper. She's produced a new compilation of his music. And Joyce Johnson describes being Jack Kerouac's girlfriend when On the Road was published. Her latest book is a collection of their letters. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.